Hey y'all, Topher here. We actually recorded this episode last Wednesday or Thursday, right after the death of Mikhail Gorbachev. We were supposed to release it last week, but we didn't. Sorry about that, but it's here now. Perhaps a little behind, but here nonetheless. Oh, and shout out to one of my all-time favorite bands, L7. I played a snippet of their song Dispatch from Mar-a-Lago in this episode. They are bitchin', and you should check them out if you haven't already. They've been around for a long time now. Anyway, thanks for listening, and here's the show. Hello, and welcome to CIA Files, True Stories of U.S. Intelligence. You know me, I'm Topher M. Ford, and today is a very special day. And it's not just special because my doctor upped my ADHD medication dosage. It's also a special day because every day is special when I have my co-host, Brandon Givens, with me. Brandon, you make things special. How are you?
Aw, that's kind of sweet. I think I'm even blushing a little bit. Yeah, I'm doing okay. We had a couple days off because it was Constitution Day yesterday here in Kazakhstan. And I did hear that the president has sent word for the bomb shelters to be inspected to make sure that they are up to snuff.
I'm sure that's just a formality.
Yeah,
There's no reason to worry.
Yeah, well, we've got a couple of weeks of flour and rice just in case, but you know, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, we were gonna for today's episode, we felt compelled to revisit Mar-a-Lago. I didn't intend to like spend a lot of time on this story, but it keeps getting crazier. But before we do that, we also, it's important for us to, I think, to discuss another bit of news that happened most recently, and that was that the death of Mikhail Gorbachev, big figure in history, titanic historical figure, I guess you'd say.
I think history is going to look a lot more kindly on him than he's looked up on now.
Well, why don't you go ahead? Can you tell us? You've got a bit here prepared about him. Can you go through that for us?
Yeah, I'll give you a biography of Gorbachev. Gorbachev was born to a farming family in rural Russia. One of his grandfathers joined and helped run a collective farm.
And he is 91 when he died, or 90. I've seen 92 also. So that was a long time ago.
Yeah, he was born like 1930 or something. And yeah, it was like he was born before World War II. In fact, he lived through the Holodomor. And he was born in 31. Yeah, he lived through the Holodomor and, you know, the great period of starvation.
Right.
And he had family die. During the Stalin purges, both of his grandfathers were arrested. They were released during World War II. His father joined the Red Army, and his region was occupied by the Germans for about 5 months. And during the war, his elementary school years, well, he didn't go to school. But after the war, he did go to school and was pretty good at it. He was a pretty good student and an avid reader. He joined the Communist Youth League and became a leader of that. They elected their leaders. And Well, a lot of people, don't understand exactly how the Communist Party works, but within itself, it can be quite democratic. It obsesses over it. but there's an in club and an out club.
Right.
All right. So he was accepted to a high school, but it was, like 10, 12 miles away from home. And he stayed at like a dorm or something. That's my understanding. It might have been, but he didn't live at home at that point. But he did walk home on the weekends to work and visit his family. And he was a pretty good farm worker. And in fact, he and his dad harvested so much grain, they got medals for it. He was awarded the Order of the Red Banner of Labor. And so, yeah, he was very good at driving a combine. So good for him. He's, a poor guy from rural Russia, family of farmers. You know, some of them died in what would be kind of like their Great Depression, perhaps worse. But at 19, he got accepted to a law school, the most prestigious law school in Moscow, and became a candidate member of the Communist Party. While at university, he developed a disdain for anti-Semitism and terror politics.
Oh, that's a good development.
Yeah, well,
not everybody felt that way.
Well, yeah, he was. I think in some ways he might have been. You know, he saw kind of the positives of the system. Like, this poor guy grew up, you know, people starving to death. But then as he's getting older, he's seeing the country improve, you know, like the farms developing, and he gets educated and he gets to go to school. And that would not have been possible for his grandparents, you know, under the old system. There wasn't social
mode. Under Stalin.
No. Stalin is how it happened. It happened to him under Stalin.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
You're saying like the improvements happened under Stalin.
Yeah, a lot of them did. Yeah. And in the 50s, like the economic improvements. Now, the freedoms didn't quite happen, but a lot of the economic did. And so he seems to have this sort of like, well, the system of communism, as far as the economics, isn't all that awful. But Stalin, don't much care for him. And he didn't much care for, again, the terror politics. And since he was like in the Communist Youth League at university, they put him in charge of it was kind of like the political officer in the dorm. So he was supposed to watch people and rat them out. But everybody knew that he wouldn't, and he apparently didn't. And he was put in charge, like the communists of the city wanted. They were having an election that the general people could vote for, and they're like, no, this is a serious election, and we want to show how serious we are about having people vote. And so they wanted 100% turnout, so for propaganda reasons. And he was part of his job was encouraging people to get out and vote. And he found that, well, people are doing it because they're scared. They don't want to. They're scared. And he didn't much like that. He graduates and gets sent back to his home region, works at like what we'd probably call something like the state attorney general's office. He's a lawyer, but he didn't really like it. So he asked for a transfer and he became the local director of the Communist Youth League. And he works his way up in the organization, and his big thing is appointing women. And eventually, so this is like 60s. He keeps getting promoted. He does well at his jobs, whatever they are, head of agriculture and then head of foreign affairs. Then he ends up in the standing committee and the secretary, the big guy. So good job.
I mean, so far, so he sounds pretty decent, like a pretty decent guy.
Yeah. I mean, he was all the way through. He was very big on reforming, and by reforming, he meant like loosening up the bureaucracy and giving people kind of like basic rights and encouraging equality in general. When Stalin died, I don't know that he was doing backflips, but he considered Stalin a traitor. Yeah, like he really embraced Khrushchev, so after Stalin, he got Khrushchev, and Khrushchev is like, yeah, Stalin was bad. He had a cult of personality. That was awful. And, Gorbachev's like, yeah, Stalin was a traitor to Marxist-Leninist ideals. So, yeah, he didn't much care for that.
Right.
And just like back to the point I was making before, just like the bureaucratic system, It's his grandparents would have never had the opportunity to education, but then he did, which is the same thing like our parents and grandparents experienced in the U.S. You know, like, oh, my grandparents, I worked on the farm and they didn't have anything. And then, but I was able to go to school with the Pell Grant and or the GI Bill and, you know, go get educated. And it's like, well, there was a generation of Soviets that experienced something similar. In 85, he was made General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Now, also in this time, or a bit before, he's one of the few people that's getting to travel abroad. And one of the things that made a strong impression upon him was how the Westerners would criticize their leaders. And he was like, okay, well, maybe this is a good thing. And of course, it ends up kind of being his downfall, but
you could see, I could see how he would think, oh, this is pretty cool after like living and growing up under Stalin, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, having, his, grandmother said she was tortured, before being released and yeah. So he's like, well, there's a good part of this system that does actually try to be helping. But then there's also this dark side that's pretty awful. And not being able to criticize the officials allowed for corruption. And so he didn't much care.
I'm glad they fixed that. Yeah. And they got rid of corruption in the...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, so with that in mind, with corruption, he becomes the big guy, he's like, all right, this is what we need to do. We need to restructure the system. And that's like rebuild this perestroika. And we need more transparency. That's glasnost. So his restructuring was to try to allow more local decision making. He tinkered a bit with the idea of going. He wanted to free the markets up a little bit, but he didn't want to get rid of central planning. And it's hard to tell what he really thought would be best versus what he thought he could accomplish. Because those can often be two very different things. It's like Obama with the Affordable Care Act. I want single payer. He might have wanted single payer, or he might have wanted, right, you know, one singular insurance system. But you got the Affordable Care Act and what that entails, because that's what could be accomplished. But one of the things he did do was he opened up free speech. So people could openly criticize the government. The press opened up a lot. He unrestricted the Orthodox Church, and he allowed more freedom of religion. And he also started, as one of the market reforms, they said, okay, well, some of the salaries, especially with agriculture, are going to be linked to outputs. And farms can sell about 30% of what they produce on an open market. But he's constantly getting stuck between a group that want greater reforms, which seem to be led by Yeltsin. And Yeltsin's big thing was just criticize whatever he did. You know, like whatever.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. It's just he was constantly just trying to gum up the works, whatever reforms he would suggest. No, I don't want that. I want more. And then there are the people that wanted to go back to the good old days. Back when we had a strong man that knew how to make people be quiet and shut up and do what they're told. When countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, when they held elections and did not elect communists, he did not intervene. He's like, he also apparently didn't think that they would completely abandon socialism or their somewhat fealty to the Soviet Union, that they might still have affection for the Soviet Union. So that might have played in why he didn't intervene. But in general, he was, he saw military and violence as not so great. And he's the one that ends up ending the Afghan War, too. And he never really supported it. He kind of inherited it and eventually ended it. He didn't stand in the way of German reunification. All right, and here's the big thing that I think people, when they look back and see what he was trying to accomplish, he's kind of underrated in history. He wanted to separate the Communist Party from the state apparatus. So, you know, like Soviet Union's this one party state, and it's basically, you know, you have all these different levels of government, and they call them Soviets, which is kind of like a Congress. Like
right.
The Soviet Union would probably be better translated as Congressional Union. And but he wanted to get rid of the party's direct control of the state. So he created something called the Congress of the People's Deputies. And people can run, you know, that was kind of open. People could run for that office. You know, it was Congress, and they did not have to be communists. And then those people would elect the president, which was something that our founding fathers discussed, having like Congress elect the president.
Right.
And so he was elected president by them. So he was the first and last president of the Soviet Union. It lasted about 1 year. All right. So he's doing that, and it pretty much, you know, takes the teeth out of the Communist Party because, well, now they don't really control all of the policymaking. And his administration, they suggested some economic reforms called the 500-day plan, and they would have moved the country very much towards a market economy. And it's probably the one thing Yeltsin kind of approved of that he came up with. Well, the Russian Soviet, which, you know, like the Russian Congress, you have to remember the Soviet Union was a union of like Russia, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Latvia. You know, I'm not going to name them all.
Well, right, but the Soviet Union wasn't, it was more than just Russia.
Correct. And so the Russian Soviet, Yeltsin was the president of that. So maybe you could think of it as the governor of the state, but they call him president. And they said, yeah, we want this 500-day plan. But the Supreme Soviet resisted it. They're like, no, we don't know. We don't know if this should go everywhere. So then Yeltsin declared that the Russian Soviet was supreme to the laws of the Soviet Union. So basically, it would be like if, you know, like Texas did say something like, oh, well, Texan laws are superior to federal laws, which, you know, was a big argument in, you know, the early U.S., like which law trumps which. So it wasn't a declaration of independence exactly, but kind of. But it was a major power play on Yeltsin's part. All right, so Lithuania, it passed some pro-independence reforms, and Gorbachev did send in troops to patrol with police, and some protesters ended up getting killed. And so he ends up being attacked by both sides. The reformers are like, why did you even send troops? And the hardliners are like, why didn't you send more troops?
Right.
You're just a pushover. And, you know, so after that, you're getting more and more talk from the different Soviets about breaking apart. So Gorbachev, he tries to salvage the Soviet Union with a rewritten constitution. He's like, look, you know, I've made this this way of moving towards democracy. Let's do that. Let's move toward this sort of more open democratic system together. There were good things about the Soviet system. You know, we have a functioning bureaucracy in place, court systems, la-di-da. Let's, you know, keep what we got going. And with that in mind, before that he could meet with the leaders of the other Soviets, there was an attempted coup. So the August Putsch. So August 1991, a group of hardliners, they tried to remove him, and they were going to bring back the good old days. But the Putsch right. failed.
And I remember that when we went over, we did this same treatment for Putin. We talked a little bit about this.
Yeah. And largely it was Yeltsin who did help stop it. You know, he's barricaded himself and like, no, Russia's its own thing. Stop it. Russia's not going to be part of the Soviet Union anymore. Kind of a nationalist thing. All right. So in the aftermath, Gorbachev, he resigns as general secretary, and he called on the Central Committee to dissolve. And in August 29th, 1991, the Supreme Soviet suspended itself, effectively ending the Communist Party activity in the Soviet Union. I think around November, Yeltsin even bans the Communist Party within Russia. So the old Soviet Union is now getting effectively free of Communist Party domination. Gorbachev still trying to salvage the Soviet Union as like, you know, a union, a tight confederation, loose federation, something. But different regions had different ideas about what they wanted. But very quickly, those ideas go to just straight independence. Because the nationalists will end up winning. So Ukraine voted right. for independence. Kazakhstan ends up becoming independent. Interestingly enough, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan were the most, at that point, the most interested in remaining part of the Soviet Union. But in the end, they broke away. Yeltsin, you know, kind of undermined any of Gorbachev's efforts, insisting more on confederation. And the leaders of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine created the CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States. And at that point, that effectively ended any hope for the Soviet Union. And then December 26, the Soviet of the Republics, you know, that's the most Soviet of all. it voted itself out of existence, and thus the Soviet Union ceased to exist. So that would be like if Congress voted to vote itself out of existence, like, okay, right. The government shall disappear, and each state is now independent. Now, after his time as office, he, you know, spent a lot of time raising money, created his own nonprofit, which was about studying his legacy, essentially. And he also has one that's about green business initiatives, which is kind of interesting. And he spent a lot of time supporting social democratic movements. And he'll chime in, or would, I mean, he's dead now, but he would chime in on politics. He liked Putin at first, but then as time went on, it was like, oh, he got really mad when he didn't leave office. You know, like Putin ran right. two terms, and then Medvedev came in, and when Putin ran again, Gorbachev. So to Gorbachev, if he's to be remembered for anything, it should be he brought freedom of religion to Russia. He brought free speech, even though the newspapers and everyone attacked him. And you know, as soon as he's like, okay, you're free to talk, they're like, we don't like you. And he eliminated the one-party system in Russia and attempted to create a, you know, like free democracy.
Yeah, it's a bummer that that one-party thing and the free democracy thing didn't last very long.
Yeah. And in some sense, one could argue, like, America screwed the pooch because he was always going to Reagan and, like, look, we want to end, we want to, like, seriously cut down our nuclear weapons. And Reagan's like, I can't really go along too much with that. You know, the hardliners in my party won't let that happen. And so it was always like Gorbachev was constantly trying to negotiate better economic terms and liberalize the country.
Right.
And he's,
but at that time, the Reagan's administration was leaning really hard into that. They were milking the last drops of that anti-communist sentiment that they could. And so I imagine that that made things more difficult in trying to deal with.
Yeah. So the sort of this party politics ruined it. And also, as the Soviet Union was like falling apart, here you've got this leader that's actively like, he is allowing, like, he does have free speech. He is like crippling the Communist Party. You would think that the Americans would love him, but it's falling apart. Like, this whole thing is kind of falling apart, and oh no, we might end up with a bunch of different countries, or he might get taken out in a coup because of economic instability. Another strong man could come in. It was a little delayed, but that happened. And he asked for loans from the West. He was like, hey, you know, like, our economy's in trouble. We're trying to modernize, but there are going to be some economic hiccups. We need some help. And the U.S. was like, oh, well, we won the Cold War. Sucks to be you. And in some ways, I think we're seeing the results of that. Of course, I mean, it's impossible to know. Like, had we helped Gorbachev and the Soviet Union transition to liberal democracy, we don't know what would have happened. But
right. Because that still wouldn't have gotten rid of the people who would become the oligarchs, all the rich crime bosses who, you know, came in and bought up all of the.
I don't know about that, because under Gorbachev, that level of for quote unquote free market might not have happened. I mean, that was his thing. Like, they wanted to go to a market.
Sold off all of the state's assets for pennies on the dollar.
Right. And to create monopolies, which are not really, you know, good for a free market.
That's not a monopoly isn't a privately owned monopoly probably isn't any better, maybe even a little worse than a state owned monopoly.
That's why you had railroads in the West, and you're a farmer, you're growing wheat, but you only have one option to get it to Chicago. It's the one railroad.
Right.
And yeah, they're not going to charge you like, oh, it costs them 10 cents a kilo to ship it. They're not going to charge you 11 cents or 12 cents and consider the 10 to 20% a fair profit. They're going to charge you whatever you can pay.
Yeah, it's a situation. One of the things I was curious about, you didn't mention Glasnost.
And Glasnost. That's transparency. That was transparency.
Okay. I just remember that term as, because I grew up, I was, in 1991, I was, 12, 13. And I remember that, this whole thing of Gorbachev. Gorbachev was in the news constantly. He was constantly being impersonated on Saturday Night Live and other shows with his trademark birthmark on his forehead. And one of the things that's resurfaced since he's died is the Gorbachev's Pizza Hut commercial. Because, Gorbachev was kind of responsible for bringing like Western business and culture into, or at least that's the impression that I've gotten, is that, he opened the door for Pizza Hut and McDonald's and things like that.
Oh, I definitely encourage it.
Yeah. A 1997 Pizza Hut commercial that he was in is making the rounds again, where you've got people sitting around eating a pizza in Russia, and Gorbachev's in the background quietly eating his pizza, and it's like a family, and they're arguing politics, and the younger guy in the family is like saying he's brought us freedom, and the older guy is like, he brought us economic problems, but he brought us opportunity, and the other guy's like, he brought us political instability, and then somebody says, he brought us Pizza Hut, and then everybody's like, yeah, that's pretty great. And it makes the whole family like agree and make peace.
That probably is that's a very apropos commercial.
yeah, and it's funny too now, because Pizza Hut is on its way out of Russia because of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. They're, from what I've been reading, they are working on selling off all of their franchise property to local owners to be rebranded, kind of like McDonald's was. Because they're like, we can't be here anymore. So
it's the circle of life, huh?
Was that like one generation, two generations that took for Putin to?
That's a good question. I would say one.
Yeah.
Yeah. One and a half.
Yeah, something like that. And yeah.
Well, I mean, that's Gorbachev. He's like, my legacy is dead. I mean, that's like, bless his heart. You know, everything he, you know, like you were saying, oh, well, good thing the one-party system is going, you know, like, well, that's back to a one-party system.
Right, but without the benefits of socialism.
Right. He is like, the press is no longer free.
Right.
Oh, yeah. It's,
I don't know if, does Russia have free healthcare?
Yeah, it's largely covered. Basic. I mean, yeah, you can go to the hospital and you're not going to go broke, but at the same time, the quality of care may not be all that great. University too. I mean, that's generally expected. But a lot of countries that do the universities tuition being covered is the program might only have so many seats. So they're like, oh, well, yeah, if you pass the test to go to law school, then yes, you can go to law school and it's covered. But we only accept 20 a year. And then they pick the top 20. And so in a lot of the world, now there are also private schools.
I was going to say, I imagine that there are private schools that come in to fill in that. It reminds me. Go ahead.
So in most of the world, going to public school means you are the cream of the crop.
Oh.
Like, oh, you got into public university, so you're really smart. And going to the private school means you really weren't that good of a student, so you had to pay for your education.
Well, that's an interesting twist.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Brandon, for going over Gorbachev for us. Interesting guy. And so let's come back to this story that I didn't intend to come back to, and that is Trump's FBI issues, what I am calling a Dispatch from Mar-a-Lago, which is a great L7 song. So, as we all know, on August 8th, the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago looking for government documents that the president took with him when he left the White House that he should not have taken. And since then, you know, it's been a hellstorm of reactions. And I mean, it's just a crazy thing. It's unprecedented for the U.S. government, for the FBI to raid a former president's home. We've learned more information since then. We know a little bit more about the contents of the boxes that the FBI took. I found what looks to be a pretty good rundown of all the information connected to what was found in the boxes. It's at a website called emptywheel.net. And I'm going to read from this article from this website. Quote, as I predicted, there is a series of paragraphs that lay out the statutory authorities implicated. This tells us how sensitive the documents in question are. It does not list the Atomic Energy Act. So that seems to say, at least hint, that there's not any actual nuclear documents in there. Don't know that for sure, but the Atomic Energy Act is not listed as one of the, acts that one of the laws that Trump broke in the affidavit. So, it does have paragraphs that define, these are the statutes that are mentioned in the affidavit. The Espionage Act, Executive Order 13526, the Executive Order governing classified information, confidential, secret, and top secret classifications. Yeah, so Executive Order 13526 was enacted in 2009 by President Obama. Confidential, secret, and top secret classifications, secure compartmented information, special intelligence, which is SIGINT. And this is from the article. He says special intelligence is SIGINT. My understanding is that SIGINT is signals intelligence, which would be, you know, like intercepted messages from foreign agents. So HCS, which refers to, which refers to clandestine human spying, FISA, which, you know, that's the secret courts that grant all of those secret warrants and wiretaps. Also the classification NOFORN, which is material not permissible to share with foreign governments. And then there's originator controlled, meaning whoever created it controls it. Need to know documents. He also listed, these are some of the charges. Or no, I'm sorry. God, my document does not, it's all messed up here. 32 CFR parts 2001 and 2003, which describes the storage requirements for classified information. So, you know, he had them apparently just in a side room somewhere that anyone could have walked into at any time. He's also being charged with obstruction, willfully removing information, the Presidential Records Act, the Federal Records Act. And then this is what the website says was found in the box. 67 confidential documents, 92 secret documents, 25 top secret documents, and then others marked HCS, FISA, ORCON, NOFORN, and SI. And then, of course, there are some documents with Trump's handwritten notes. And if you remember, it seems like most of this, like the search for this information, started with the National Archive looking for stuff that they knew or that
nerds should be there.
A lot of that being. Yes. So, you know, like since this came out, and obviously they can't say, the FBI can't say, this is exactly what we found because, you know, it's top secret stuff. A lot of people have been making wild speculations. I saw like there were headlines for a few days about an ex FBI officer investigator who went on to CNN and said, maybe it's got a list of all the CIA officers out in the world. Maybe it's got
aliens. Maybe
it was like, yeah. I mean, and I
well, CNN. What are you doing? Was,
you know,
I mean, that's okay. That's okay on a podcast. But come on, CNN. What are you doing?
Well, that was the thing that got me is like, okay, this person you have, he's got some inside knowledge in general. But he doesn't have any specific knowledge about this case. And he's going on there and he says, you know, like he just says some stuff. Maybe he said it, you know, like emphatically. Maybe he says it in passing, but it turns into a million headlines. And that every other news organization prints this story. Are there CIA? Was there a list of CIA officers in there? It's like. Maybe there was a list of every time President Trump took a dookie. We don't know, you know? So that was frustrating. Now some, the DOJ did release, this was in, court documents that were released to the public, some photos of document cover sheets that showed top secret on them. There was one photo of a bunch of different top secret documents kind of spread out over the tasteless gaudy rug at Mar-a-Lago. It's getting more interesting because the DOJ is also looking into the possibility of obstruction of justice. The DOJ stated that it, quote, developed evidence that government records were likely concealed and removed from the storage room and that efforts were likely taken to obstruct. So They're talking now that about the likelihood that Donald Trump's lawyers, after the first time that they met and handed over boxes of documents to the FBI, that they knew that there was more stuff and they took extra efforts to hide that stuff. So, yeah, case keeps getting in more interesting. Another thing, many of the documents that are currently under review are so sensitive that the FBI counterintelligence officers and staff who are reviewing them required extra security clearance before they could actually look at them. So
we're talking about that's a tactic stuff here. Commit a crime involving papers so sensitive you could never have a jury of your peers able to hear it to convict you.
I mean, that is a twist. That's a complication. Yeah, we'll see how that plays out. And then Trump, you know, he's said lots of different, very different things since this happened, which is, you know, his kind of his MO. Just the first thing that pops into his head, he, I was going to say tweets it, but he truth socials it, which, by the way, his social media, the app for his social media site was removed from the Google Play Store because of a lack of moderation.
Do you mean Donald Trump's going to be involved in a failed business?
Oh, no. Maybe. I mean, okay. Anyway, but since then, he said there were no secret documents. And then he said, wait, those are mine. And then the most recent thing was he said he was demanding via social media, by the way, because I guess he doesn't understand how lawyers work, even though he's had so many. Maybe that's why he's having trouble finding them now. But he demanded via social media that a special master be appointed to review the documents before the FBI could look through them, to look for anything that is his that doesn't belong in there or that should be covered under attorney-client privilege, which to me kind of sounds like, you know, if the police were to raid my home and take all of the stuff in here that, like, they're saying that I'm a drug trafficker, and they come in and take all the stuff, you know, my files, my receipts, my bookkeeping that shows I was trafficking drugs. And then I said, wait a minute, before you look at any of that, you need to let my buddy Brandon go through it and take out anything that he doesn't think belongs in there. You know, I don't know. I guess it is a thing in certain cases. The DOJ said that his request lacks standing because the records in question didn't belong to him. They belong to the U.S. government. Also, by the time he had made this request for a special master, the FBI filter team, who was tasked with doing basically what he was wanting.
You keep saying special master. They had already done it. I want to know if that is a real legal term, like guardian ad litem.
It sounds like it. From what I understood, at least the context of what I read implies that there are instances where that is a thing. I didn't dig too much into it.
Okay, yes, it is a thing. I was like, this sounds like some top dom S&M something. But okay, no, it is a law thing.
Yeah, so but yeah, the FBI was like, I mean, it's a moot point because we've already done it. We already looked at everything. They were a filter team. A screening team that was, you know, their job was to do what he wanted the special master to do, which was look for things that weren't related to the case or that would fall under attorney-client privilege. So, yeah, I mean, and a lot of people came out to say that this is Trump didn't actually necessarily want this. It was another attempt to delay things. You know, because that's a big legal strategy. Delay
defect,
slow down,
distract.
Kind of try to gum the works. Yeah. So yeah, that's where we're at now. This also, the whole situation brought up this issue with a Ukrainian woman posing as a Rothschild visiting Mar-a-Lago. And this story is, it's weird because it's related, because she was, you know, an imposter, and she got inside of Mar-a-Lago multiple times. It sounds like at least for a little while there, she was kind of a fixture at Mar-a-Lago, and she met President Trump. She met Lindsey Graham. She met former Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. I didn't see any information that, you know, she had, that she was spying for a government, at least not yet. There was the best source of information for what she's been doing. There's a website, or there's an article online that was published by the Post Gazette. And I'll, you know, of course, we'll have that link and other links, related links, at the website, CIAfiles.net. But they did a pretty good deep dive into this woman. So let's talk about her. She is a Russian. This is a Russian speaking immigrant from Ukraine named Inna Yashchichin. I think I'm saying that right. Her father is a Russian born or Ukrainian born truck driver who now lives in Illinois. Sounds like middle class, you know, blue collar family. So she lived in Miami, and so she posed as a woman named Anna de Rothschild whenever she visited Mar-a-Lago starting in May of 2021. So this is after.
I wonder, maybe, was this about the same time that the Inventing Anna came out? Maybe she copied Anna Sorokin.
It is. And actually, if you start looking for stories about this, you see them use that in the headline a lot. And, you know, I've also seen like the real Inventing Anna. So I haven't watched that documentary, but yeah, people, maybe she saw it and got the idea. Yeah. I don't know.
I remember reading about it, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. And the movie came out not too long ago. Our series.
Was it a movie, a series, or documentary?
Fictionalized, but it's still kind of fun.
But yeah. Based on
something. Depending on who you ask.
Okay. Right. Yeah. But yeah, so she had a Florida driver's license and a lot of other official government identifications, including a passport, under that name, Anna de Rothschild. It listed her address as a $13 million mansion in Miami Beach, which was obviously wrong. When she was confronted about the false identity, Yashchichin said, quote, "I think there's been some misunderstanding." Now, and she said that her former business partner is trying to frame her for revenge. The partner is a man named Valery Tarasenko. He's a Russian-born businessman. He ran a charity in Canada called United Hearts of Mercy. And 5 years after he started that charity, Yashchichin, I keep worrying that I'm saying that wrong, but Yashchichin became the head of another charity in Florida with the same name. The charity claims to help pregnant Russians come to America to have their babies in America.
I don't know if that's a charitable cause exactly, but okay.
Well, actually, now that I mention it, it may not have even been a charity. It may have been a for-profit business. But it certainly has a charity name. It was called the United Hearts of Mercy. So if it wasn't a charity, it's sure trying to look like one.
I like Anchor Baby Express.
What is that from?
I just made it up.
Oh, nice.
Maybe somebody else got it first, but.
But so
TM trademark.
The United Hearts of Mercy, which is currently under suspicion of being a front organization that funnels money to Russian mobsters. Two different payment processors, including Stripe, dropped the organization recently when they detected fraud. Another person who worked at United Hearts of Mercy said that shortly after that happened, she started getting lots of calls from people with foreign accents threatening to kill her and her family if they didn't get their money. So United Hearts of Mercy may not be on the up and up. The newspaper who did the article found a list of email for the people who've donated money. And most of those emails were listed as being from Hong Kong. They sent an email to maybe all of the emails that they found. They sent a bunch of emails out to these donors asking them, and all of the emails they sent were returned as non-deliverable. So again, things don't look good for this United Hearts of Mercy charity. And I saw a mention, I can't remember where now, so maybe it's irresponsible of me to mention it, but I saw a mention of, you know, being under suspicion of sex trafficking, human trafficking. So I don't know. There's a lot of room for a lot of shady stuff there when you talk about, you know, bringing women over from one country to America.
There's a word for it, trafficking.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that begs the question, you know, what was she doing at Mar-a-Lago if she wasn't there, you know, spying for another government? It's hard to say.
Ah, but oh no, that's where Epstein's people were hanging out. No.
No. So
I think she was working with Trump to investigate Epstein and what's her name that just was found guilty too.
I don't think you actually believe that, do you?
I could imagine that in a parallel universe.
Yeah. It seems like from what I read reading through the article, and like they talked to different people who knew her, because she was also using that name, Anna de Rothschild, in a role as a music promoter. While she was at Mar-a-Lago, people fawned over her. People loved her because they all believed she was a Rothschild. And she constantly was talking about real estate deals in and around Miami and Southern Florida. So I kind of think that she was going in there scouting for investors, you know. And by investors, I mean people who would give her money and then probably never hear from her again.
She may have been doing the Anna Sorokin, which at the same time, I mean, from what I get, that lady, had she gotten the loan like she was fraudulently applying for, she might have actually made a profitable business and paid it off.
This is who again?
Anna Sorokin, the one from Inventing Anna that was pretending to be rich. And I mean, she did kite some checks sort of things, but her big thing was trying to get a multi-million dollar loan to, you know, start some kind of like art gallery / club something. And I don't know. I mean, she might have made it work. Right. She actually got the money and then paid, you know, worked to pay off the loan. But it was just she was using fraud to get the loan. And so who knows? This lady, fake it till you make it. Maybe she was there fishing for investments and she would have paid them back, maybe. Who knows? I like to see the best in people.
Yeah. And then it said that she was given a basic screening before being allowed. They checked her ID. They checked her for weapons, but they didn't perform any background check, which according to every, like, apparently that was a bad idea. So, but yeah, so we're going to keep an eye out for more because this is that's a pretty interesting story there. That's going to be it for this week. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out. Social media, twitter.com, @CIA Files Podcast, Instagram @CIA Files, facebook.com/CIAfiles, and of course our lovely website CIAfiles.net. And in the meantime, you know, take care of yourselves out there. It can get rough. And yeah, later.
Bye-bye.